Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. I have as my guest today a pioneer in research on spinal cord injuries and orgasm. Dr. Mitchell Tepper has become an internationally recognized sexuality educator, disability expert, and as I said before, a pioneer in this field. I've known Dr. Mitch for quite a few years. Welcome to the program, Dr. Mitchell Tepper. It's so good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Do you remember 2001? We were at the World Congress for Sexology in Paris. And you and I and several others went out on the town one night in Gay Petty, and your wheelchair did not hold you back. Do you remember
it
that?
It hardly ever does.
Good. Good. Well, I remember it as being a lovely evening, and of course I see you at conferences, and you have collaborated or are collaborating with Dr. Schoen, and you're doing a film, Love After War, Making Love After Making War. And we're going to talk a little more about that, you and I and Mark Schoen, on March 7th. We may or may not have Mark Schoen joining the program then. But for today, we're going to focus in on the five secrets to pleasure and connectedness, which is really, I guess it's seven secrets, five to seven anyway, based on your book, Regain That Feeling, Secrets to Sexual Self-Discovery. And this is a wonderful book. I have thoroughly read chapter 8 anyway, and people can do that by, also do that by going to your website, drmitchelltepper.com. Dr. Mitchell, can you tell us how you got into this field? Tell us your story. I know your story, but I know the listeners would love to hear it. And by the way, listeners, if you want to join the program, if you yourself have a disability, or you are aware of Dr. Mitchell's work and would like to contribute to the conversation, you need to call 888-874-4888. You'll talk to Zach. He'll no doubt screen your call and put you on the air. So, Mitchell, Dr. Mitch,
I tell people I literally dove head first into this field.
Yes.
So I was in school for business and finance. It was in between my junior and senior year. Mm-hmm. And I was working as a lifeguard. I have a history of Crohn's disease before. So that's inflammatory bowel disease before my spinal cord injury. And I had some surgery. Actually, I had to leave school in the middle of my junior year and have some surgery, which led to an ileostomy bag. So it's like a bag that collects poop on your side. And the doctor said, don't let that bag keep you from doing what you want. And I said, I want my job back as a lifeguard. And so really on my first weekend back, I used to hide that bag underneath my bathing suit. And I was going out just to fix a buoy. And I ran in the water and I dove over a line, you know, with some buoys on it that separated the deeper end. And would usually just do a flip. On this day, I went a little too deep. I only had one hand in front of me. The other hand was holding a wrench to go out and fix something. And I head planted. And that set me on a whole different path. I did eventually go back to school and finished a degree in finance. And I worked in banking, but it wasn't satisfying me. And I migrated my way over after a degree in public health, thinking I wanted to run a rehab hospital, to sexual health, because this was an area that was very important to me. You know, when I first broke my neck, they told me chances were less than 10% in response to my question, will I ever have children? And they said less than 10% chance. They didn't offer me any other hope, any other referrals. any other things about my concerns about my sexuality. And so I was left on my own, literally to take things into my own hands. And I write about that in the book, you know, trying to talk a nurse into helping me and trying to figure things out on my own. So that's what happened. So I ended up moving from public health to doing a master's in studying sex education and counseling and spinal cord injury rehab programs. And I saw that there was a big unmet need, and I went on and got a PhD in human sexuality education at the University of Pennsylvania.
And if people can go to your website, drmitchelltepper.com, they can actually also access your Chapter 8.
We could put a link online. It's drmitchelltepper.com/secrets revealed.
Secrets revealed.
They need to put that there because it's not a regular link. This is something I offer for people who listen, to one of my webcasts or radio shows.
Yeah, good. And people can also go to Sex Smart Films. The beginning of January, I had Dr. Mark Schoen as a guest, and he's the founder of Sex Smart Films. And under the education section on Sex Smart Films is disability. And there are several wonderful films that feature you, one on Tantra, one on erectile dysfunction, one on facilitated sex, and pleasure maps, the importance of touch, and so on. And these are very well done films. Plus, on your website, you have some YouTubes.
Right. I have all those videos also at drmitchelltepper.com. Under projects, there's a sex and paralysis video series. So that has the Tantra and the Sensate Focus. And there's, a media channel that has all the YouTube.
Right, the media channel, and I watched several of them, and it helped inform me. I have, in my practice, I have one fellow who is disabled, and he came to me actually 3.5 years ago now with some real concerns about his sexuality and not feeling much. And so I'm aware of a lot of this, and it's helpful, but I'm become extra inspired from looking again at your website. It's really, really helpful. I think that your 7 secrets about orgasms, too, could help even non-disabled people, because it's some very good information about reaching orgasm. I really, really think that you are a blessing because you really know about this field. And as you put it, you dove headfirst into it. But you've made the most and the best of your situation, which could have destroyed a lot of people. And you even have a wonderful wife and a son. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, I was very motivated after I broke my neck to regain that feeling, to discover, what I had left for my sexual potential. As I mentioned, I was in the middle of my junior year when I broke my neck, and that interrupted my schooling for a year. And I went back about a year and a half later for September. And when I went back to school, I needed to live in an accessible dorm. And where I lived was on the ground floor. They called it the pit of a 4-story unit. And in one of the classes I took called Problem Solving and Decision Making Analysis, it was a computer class. And I thought, this was back in 1983, that would be good for me to take a second computer course. And turns out it was a course that computer nerds took because there was no computers in it. But I did meet my wife there, Cheryl. And it turned out we lived in the same dorm now. I had met her briefly at a party before I broke my neck. And I don't know, for some reason before I broke my neck, I said, if I ever date anybody, this was a commitment I made before breaking my neck, if I ever date anyone for 6 months, I'm going to marry them. Because most of my relationships were summertime or short, and I get kind of bored and break up. And so after 5 months, it was coming to a point where she was finishing. She finished school in 85. I finished 84. You know, it was like we were either going to be apart or together. And so, you know, I stayed in my claim. I said, I'd like to get married. And I know we have, you know, you have a year left of school. We'll work through that and getting a job. And so we had a long engagement. And you know, when we got married, I wasn't sure I could have children. And that was okay with her because she didn't physically want to have children. She was afraid at the time. So adoption was always, you know, in our potential plans for the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, 10 years into our marriage, you know, after her brother and sister had children, and she began to get that feeling, I'd like to have children. And I said, I'd like to have a baby for graduation from my master's program. And so we proceeded on that. And actually, you had probably had Dr. Beverly Whipple on the show, and I was doing my research with her and Dr. Barry Komisarek at Rutgers. And she gave me some guidance on how to do at-home insemination. And I wrote about this way back probably in 2006 or 2007 called Vibromassage or Making Babies, Vibromassage and At-Home Insemination. And so I was able to use a vibrator to elicit an ejaculation because that's an issue, that's a sexual dysfunction that happens quite common in men with spinal cord injuries. And we were able to inseminate Cheryl at home. And, you know, after... probably, you know, 6 to 9 months of trying, we were successful. And so Jeremy is now 20 years old. And
how
he's
is
our one
Jeremy
and only.
Doing? There are some lovely pictures of him as a little guy with the two of you.
He's great. As a big guy, he works for me sometimes. He's on the pilot video, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks, on Love After War. It was really... him as a cameraman and one of his fraternity brothers, Antonio Garcia, who's a very talented filmmaker. They're all at GSU, Georgia State University. And so Antonio's in the film school and another brother who's a musician. So we actually went out and did the pilot interview. So, you know, it was him and his fraternity brothers who did the first pilot, which, you know, we'll talk about later. But when I showed that to Mark, that's when he kind of got on board. You know, he was really moved. You know, so he's doing well. He's a computer science major over at Georgia State University.
So he's computer science and film school.
No, he's just a hobbyist for cameras.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, his brother.
Computer science will always get him a job. But I think it's great that he can contribute to yours and Mark's project.
Yeah.
Yeah, and... I only saw in some of the TV things, I only saw him as a little boy, but he looks adorable. And I'm sure he's adorable as a 20-year-old, too.
Yeah, he's 6 foot tall now. And, looks like his mother and his father, so he's got to look good.
I know. I could see the resemblance in both of you. What a difference it made. And it does make a difference to many spinal cord injury people to be able to go ahead and... conceive a child, whatever method. And I know that the urology store that I sometimes deal with and for my clients has the Vibrorect thing where the penis is put in this kind of holder and it vibrates. But I don't think back when you did it, they had such sophisticated devices. Or maybe
they didn't.
No, they didn't.
So, you know, we actually used a big Panasonic, like muscle massager with an adjustable speed. So that's called a rheostat. So there are two things, like in the literature, there was a medical vibrator called FertiCare, which makes a home unit now. But back then it was just for you know, in the hospital. And so there's something called peak-to-peak amplitude, is how much the head moves, and then the frequency, how fast it vibrates. So, you know, that was, you know, fortunate that worked for me, and that will work for some people. And I've written, people could read the article, Making Babies, that might be on my website, but a newer article I wrote last February for this New Mobility magazine called The Ejaculation Affirmation, and why this thing is so important to men, even if they can't feel it in their genitals, you know, even if it causes them, you know, severe risk for stroke or a heart event from the vibromassage. So it's called The Ejaculation Affirmation. Just search that and it will come right up with my name.
Wait, just Ejaculation Affirmation.
Right. In my research, which the book Regain That Feeling is largely based on, I did a lot of qualitative research. And, you know, in a situation where one partner has a disability, the other doesn't, and especially if the partner with a disability doesn't have sensation, I'm going to use the word sensation from now instead of feeling, because, you know, one of the myths is
good. Yes, good.
About feeling. So lost sensation, especially what you're used to, is that, you know, the partner is concerned about pleasing you. You know, and you might say, you know, I'm perfectly satisfied. That was great. But if they're used to seeing ejaculation, you know, they're not convinced until they see the white, you know, with their own eyes. Mm-hmm. Then it's left up for question, because what we know, usually in the, you know, typical script, is that ejaculation means you are satisfied and that I did a good job pleasing you. So, you know, it was, that came up a lot. So for partners, so the kind of need to really believe them, you know, that is a typical cue. And, you know, once again, going off topic onto veterans, but when I'm working with large groups of injured veterans, whether they have, most of them don't have spinal cord injuries, but they have, may have a PTS or PTSD or a brain injury, or even just pain and orthopedic injuries, but on multiple medications. This is in heterosexual couples mostly, the partners would say, what do I do, you know, if he can't finish? You know, so that's, mm-hmm. that's a big concern. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so I have to talk about people about rewriting sexual scripts. You know,
right.
And a lot of, in the Sex and Paralysis video series that I have on my site, is talking about being creative, learning to adapt, having a sense of humor, because these things are necessary, and especially the creativity to kind of rewrite your scripts, rewrite your story. You know, the typical story being, you know, first comes love, then marriage, then so and so in a baby carriage, and then another mm-hmm. one would be, you know, first base, second base, third base, home run, right? And so these are
right.
To understand these stories that are, you know, deep in our culture. Most people could identify with both the nursery rhyme and the baseball phenomenon, even younger people today. And so these are ingrained in us, and we don't know what to do. We're lost,
mm-hmm.
You know, when things are changed. It doesn't have to be as significant as a spinal cord injury with loss of movement and feeling and, or, real severe sexual dysfunction. You could have, you know, a prostate cancer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, no longer get a good erection. And totally be lost. You know, you could have a hysterectomy. You could even have, you know, breast surgery, you know, and it doesn't even have to be a reproductive cancer. You could have a cancer that, you know, is treated with, you know, radiation or something, and that, you know, wreaks havoc on your hormones, you know, and affects your sexuality. So, you know, when there's a change, you know, people have a hard time dealing with it.
You said to me in our pre-interview, without loss, it's very typical for people to take things for granted. Of course, I see many, many couples who don't have any disability and they're still taking things for granted. But when you have loss, you have to face it and explore new ways of doing things. And, of course, humor is important. You've already mentioned that. And creative adaptability. Adaptability is a big word in your field, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
You
adaptive equipment.
Yes. And you, so you have seven secrets revealed in your chapter eight in your book, Regain That Feeling, Secrets to Sexual Self-Discovery. And the first one is pleasure is not merely a physical sensation. Now, we've already touched on this a little, but would you expand on that, Mitch, please?
Well, yeah. Earlier this afternoon, I participated in a webinar hosted by United Spinal on sex toys and adaptive equipment. And still, I mean, one of the questions that came up from the participants is, what do I do, you know, if I don't have any more feeling? And, you know, feeling is not merely a physical sensation. We all have feelings. Feelings is, you know, mediated via your brain, right? So we know that if the spinal cord is severely, you know, damaged or cut, then we don't have sensations. You know, you might touch my leg and I don't feel it. But we also have emotional feelings too. There's no one who doesn't have any feelings. So, you know, whether it's burns over 80% of their body or whatever, you know, I could find someplace where they'll have tactile sensation, right? Or in their mouth, on their lips. But, you know, besides that, I mean, we have, you know, fantasy, you know, smells. These things trigger feelings, right? And so I teach people, you know, and that's why both the pleasure mapping or the sensate focus type exercises, I teach people to explore what they have, tactile sensation with touch. But I also focus on breathing, you know, and sound and things that could move vibrational sexual energy through your body. And so most people don't ever take the opportunity to really get in touch with their sexual potential. So, you know, through this, and you know, I do a little workshop called Tantra, Mindfulness and the Yoga of Sex. So mindfulness is all the buzz now, right? And I talk about people have access to mindfulness. And I believe it a lot, but I also believe that Tantra has been around for 3,000 plus years, and you know, and it comes from the same root. So I just say mindfulness is you know, Tantra medicalized for the 21st century. It's much easier to teach mindfulness at the VA than it is to Tantra, right? So try to get a Tantra class at the VA. So I tell people take advantage of their mindfulness class, right? Yeah. Yes, I am. And then also, you're not going to find a tantrika or anything, you know, well-trained.
No.
And then
no.
also, you know, you could take yoga, you know, and adaptive yoga, you know, they have it a lot of places. So yoga, you work on your breathing, you work on your centering, right? You could work on some stretching or whatever amount you can do. You know, people in a wheelchair, I advise, you know, getting out and, you know, getting help and spreading their legs and, you know, getting on the ground if they can or on a mat. So through breath, through sound, as I said, through vibrations, which we could, you know, learn those. And then if someone, then we take, you know, those mindfulness skills and those yoga skills and we use our intention, because, you know, when we're talking about sexuality and we're talking about mindfulness or yoga, we talk about, you know, our intentions and where we put our attention, right? And so I teach people to, you know, have an intention, a sexual intention, and put their attention where they have good feelings to focus on those. And you know, people, even with women with complete spinal cord injuries, no feeling from their neck down, they have maybe some kind of deep sensation from their, you know, clitoris or from an internal orgasm, but they could focus in on just the tiniest remnant of a sensation and build to orgasm. And that orgasm we've measured in the lab, you know, and that's what this research first, I was the laboratory research with Drs. Whipple and Komisark, and we looked at women in a laboratory and with and without spinal cord injuries, and, you know, 3 out of 15 women with complete spinal cord injuries who weren't supposed to be able to have orgasms, according to the literature, did. And we measured that. We measured, you know, different things like touch sensitivity and pain attenuation and also, you know, spasticity, which is something that goes down afterwards. And we looked at their eye pupils. And then we also had the women report. If they're saying, I'm having an orgasm, they said that, and they would choose a scale of pleasure from 0 to 10. And so, you know, measuring and blood pressure, So measuring all these correlates with orgasm, physiological correlates, 3 out of 15 women with complete spinal cord injuries experienced an orgasm in the lab. That's being, with 2 PhD nurses in the room, Beverly and Eleanor Richards, right?
Yeah.
With equipment hooked up to them, stimulating themselves with a transducer, this thing we made that they would stimulate their cervix with and their interior wall of the vagina, stopping every few minutes to take all these measurements. With all that distraction going on, they were able to have an orgasm. And then we compared those results with able-bodied women. And in another study at Rutgers in women with spinal cord injuries, also, when the results, like the descriptions of the women were given to blinded reviewers, not blind reviewers, but reviewers that didn't know which participant was able-bodied or spinal cord injured, they couldn't tell by the description which women had injury and which didn't. So, once you get to that experience of orgasm, now men, in general, are kind of different. We connect orgasm more with ejaculation, and it gets really confusing because, it's one and the same until you experience separately, right? And so, but for women, don't always focus on like the contractions they feel around their, in the pelvic floor or the pre-coxial muscles. It's not what they say. It's not the description, that they give. And so in the research with women, there was, people who didn't know which the description came from a woman with or without, couldn't tell the difference. So, if you get to that, and I think this really has to be experienced. You can't just read about this and it happens. You have to practice, you have to relearn. You have to re-educate your areas that have touch. You have to get yourself out of your own way, the roadblocks in your mind. You have to, I'm a sexologist. I'm not a licensed mental health professional. Some are, but my PhD is in education. And so I do education and counseling, and I work as a coach because another dear friend of ours, Dr. Bill Staton, who I took my sex therapy course from.
He is wonderful, isn't he? Bill
Staton. Said in class, I'll always remember it, that 70% of people's problems are solved through education. First part of education is myth busting, is giving them accurate information for all those things that they never got regarding pleasure and orgasm. And then teaching them about human sexual response cycles in the plural, all the different ways that we can respond sexually in all the different models and seeing what fits. And then practicing the skills I talked about, which are kind of touched on in the sex and paralysis video series. But as you said, and these things are all universal, some of the secrets, quote unquote, I reveal, the secrets are in response to the myth that came out of the interviews I did with these folks. So I would ask them, tell me about your sexuality after your injury. So all the people in my research after the laboratory, this is a much larger group of men and women with spinal cord injuries, experienced orgasm before their injury, but some did and some didn't afterwards. And so I'd ask them this question, and they'd say, it's not the same, it's not normal. And I'm like, okay, I was expecting them to be like me. I could get an erection, but I can't ejaculate. I don't understand why it's happening. But they were more like, it's not the same, it's not normal. And what's the same or what's normal for someone who's like acquired a traumatic spinal cord injury was what was normal for them the day before, their accident. And the same thing with somebody who steps on a landmine, that what's normal for them is what's normal, the day before. When I work with people who have developmental disabilities or disabilities since birth, their normal is a reference of what's normal in the culture. So, since they didn't have an able-bodied normal, a lot of them, I'll have guys in their 20s with muscular dystrophy ask me if men with muscular dystrophy could have sex. I'm like, well, what do you mean by sex? So I don't just say yes. And I break that down, and it turns out, that's the kind of condition that doesn't affect erection, doesn't affect ejaculation. It does affect mobility, and it does, a lot of people have not met anybody yet. They have not dated yet when they come to me. That's actually a big issue, is that, they haven't had a sexual relationship So that's not only young people. I've worked with people over 50 with spinal cord injuries that hadn't had their first sexual experience because of, you know, being, you know, afraid to go there. And now at this point in their life, you know, they're reaching out.
Dr. Mitchell, when you do the coaching with, say, people with muscular dystrophy and some vets and so on, can you do some of this by Skype or by phone?
I do most of my work by Skype or by phone, mm-hmm. and depending on what people are comfortable with, you know, generally there's an initial conversation by Skype. I don't feel a strong need to see people in person, and people come to me. One of my clients right now is in Paris. Another guy was in Croatia. Mm-hmm. So people come to me from all over the world because of they find me online or they read my book, you know.
Yes.
And so, you know, I love working with people in person. I love doing workshops. But, you know, some people, well, in 1996 when I started the website sexualhealth.com, which, you know, isn't mine anymore, but I ran that for 15 years.
You sold it, didn't you, in 1990?
Yeah. When did you sell it? 2010,
that's right.
Yeah,
and
it's still a website.
But it's a very good website.
Yeah, but the focus is more on STD testing now. So,
yeah, I see.
You know, we
yeah.
used to have thousands of pages on, you know, all types of disabilities, rare disabilities, developmental disabilities, autism. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. they moved the focus more towards, you know, STD testing, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping that we would grow the site to e-counseling and more general, you know, sexuality, but, you know, they stayed focused there. So, you know, I continue to do my work.
But in any case, people can get coaching from you. And I
right.
learned from the show last week, which was Valentine's Day, and Michael Jonas and his wife Barbara and I were talking about their romance games, and there were free
yeah.
downloadables. And we had, Mr. Jonas tells me that they got free downloadables from Jakarta, Indonesia, from Australia, from Canada, from various places in the U.S., Hawaii included. So apparently this show has a global reach, and I'm hoping that some of our listeners, perhaps the ones with disabilities, will take advantage of your coaching and contact
yeah.
you.
Because
people in some foreign countries, well, you said you had a client in Croatia.
Right.
They're probably going to have difficulty finding resources for specific help like this.
Yeah, an occupational therapist called in from South Africa today, and she said there was absolutely no sexologist, no resources for, you know, people in rehabilitation, spinal cord injury or otherwise, in all of South Africa. And I'm like, okay.
Oh, wow.
So we have to work on getting me down there, you know, and doing some staff training, because I also work with, you know, health professionals and teach
yeah.
health professionals on how to take a good sexual health assessment and how to provide, you know, basic level of education and counseling.
Yes. So when you work with health officials and you train them, more than the intake, what else do you emphasize when you're working with health officials on the front line?
It depends how much time I have with them. You know, so I have a curriculum that I work off that I developed in the 90s called Providing Comprehensive Sexual Health Care. So
mm-hmm.
if I have 3 days to work with them, the first day is all around. It's almost like a little SAR, which is in our field, a sexual attitude reassessment seminar. So
right.
I'm working on, you know, what their feelings and attitudes around sexuality and disability themselves, building out a definition of sexuality across the lifespan, you know, to get that really broad-based definition of sexuality that's bio, psycho, social, relational, emotional,
mm-hmm.
spiritual, right? Really
mm-hmm.
opening up their view of sex to sexuality, and then moving it towards the specific disability. So the curriculum was originally for spinal cord injury, but I delivered it over 3 days at Walter Reed National Military Hospital for their sexual health and intimacy work group. So I incorporated the different types of combat injuries, from brain injury and PTS to burns, and multiple limb loss, genital injuries. So that kind of module I substitute, and then we go towards skill building. So we take what they learned on the first day, and we do some of the exercises I do. I do the same with health professionals as people with disabilities. I do an erotic grab bag, which, expands people's, imagination and creativity. And then we do some case studies that are generated by the group. And, when I have a lot of time on the third day, we actually do, structured clinical exams, where we have, people trained as patients, and the health providers actually do interviews with them, and there's very structured feedback. So, a lot of sexuality education and training falls short on skill development, mm-hmm. and it also sometimes falls short on addressing people's attitudes. So, my feeling as an educator is that, I've kind of written down everything I know. You could go regain that feeling, Secrets to Sexual Self-Discovery. I did a booklet on spinal cord injury for United Spinal. You could go download that for free, right? Mm-hmm. I did 4 volumes on sexual health. So there are things you can read, but you don't often get a chance to, share your feelings about a explicit movie where some person has a spinal cord injury with other people and, share what, how scary it is to you for if it was you, and get that off your chest, and then see positive portrayals, because I do show, videos with very positive portrayals of people with disabilities having sex. Those opportunities you don't get, and you don't get an opportunity to practice in a kind of real life situation. So, that's, ideally, the more time I get, most education is you kind of drive by, you get an hour and a half, 2 hours here, a few hours there. So it's piecemeal.
Yes. You talk about the intimate connection that includes safety and all of that really fuels desire. And that, of course, that does for able-bodied people. Can you expand a little bit on that, the intimate connection?
Yeah. So, one of the secrets is that trust, safety, and connectiveness matter more than physical or general function to the experience of orgasm. We know that from people with spinal cord injuries, that their level, whether they broke their neck or their back or complete, whether they could feel or not, doesn't determine sexual satisfaction, or you can't tell, based on someone's level or completeness of injury, if they're the ones that are having an orgasm or not. So we know that. And in my research, when I asked them, tell me about your sexual experience, it's not the same, it's not normal, and then they try something like masturbation, and they say it's pointless, why bother, or their partner, cheated on them or left them or avoided having sex with them, and they said, okay, it's pointless, why bother. I asked everyone, tell me about a peak sexual experience, orgasm or no orgasm, because I'm interested in helping people, mm-hmm. Optimize their sexual, experience, not necessarily, have orgasm. And they said it was someone I trusted, so they needed this kind of context of trust and safety. And with that, they felt a sense of connectedness. When they had that sense of connectedness, that was the bridge to feeling pleasure and an experience orgasm for the first time, sometimes 10, 12, 15 years after their injury, often after leaving, especially like the women, the 15 women in the lab, often the first orgasm was like leaving a bad relationship and when they got into a new relationship. And they didn't always have to be long-term. Some women had experience with other guys with spinal cord injuries when they were in the hospital, or in a support group. And so being with someone else with the same injury where they didn't have to explain about their balls and their bladders, and someone had already learned the ropes themselves, gave them the context they needed. And wherever you, if you're doing, any kind of couples work, and you're looking at different types of like attachment theories, context makes all the difference. Or if you're looking at sexual response cycles and you're looking at, either like the tipping point model, or whether you look at, the sexual excitation, it's a dual control model where we have, like a gas pedal, a sexual accelerator, that's excitation, or you have a brake, which is sexual inhibitions. So when we look at that and all the components of what turns us on and what turns us off, that's all context, right? And that we know that context matters more, you know, and I could give you as a woman, if you're having a problem with excitement, all the Viagra I want. If the context ain't right, you know, women frustrate the hell out of pharmaceutical companies because you give them the Viagra, they do lubricate, but they won't report sexual satisfaction or increased pleasure. Right?
You know, I saw that directly 10 years ago when I worked in Los Angeles at UCLA's Female Sexual Medicine Center, and Dr. Jennifer Berman, a urologist, was working for Pfizer to try to prove that Viagra would work for women, and of course, it didn't. Women, a very aware woman who was in a good relationship could tell after she took Viagra. I, for instance, I tried it, and I was aware of more genital sensation.
Yes. And, you know, I don't mean to cut you off, but surprisingly, those clinical trials only continued to another phase in women with spinal cord injuries. And I have a theory for that as someone who took Viagra myself, is that with someone with a spinal cord injuries who's not feeling the genital sensations, are feeling the other things like the warmth, the sex flush, and are more tuned in to those physiological responses that are all part of sexuality. So, yes, a lot of people are using this off-label, and it does work for people, you know, because it does, you know, increase engorgement and lubrication. Mm-hmm. And if that's part of the issue, and it does give you, you know, that overall sympathetic response, which is part of the sexual response. So, yeah, so you're definitely, I'm not discounting that has a physiological effect, but not enough for enough women to get it approved.
So in your Seven Secrets Revealed, Chapter 8, in your book, Regain That Feeling, Secrets to Sexual Self-Discovery, you have desire, which is, I like the way you put it.
Right.
The calling card of intimate connections. So the desire is apt to come more to the forefront when there is this connection. And we know this about women, that the famous slide where you've got the on-off switch for the man, and you've got this full board of dials and lights and all of that for the woman. I mean, women tend to be a little more complicated in terms of their sexual response, and that's why the current drug that's been FDA approved, Addy, for the most part for female sexual desire, low desire, is not working very well.
We have to understand, and I wrote an article, it's probably up on LinkedIn on that. People who actually have hypoactive sexual desire disorder is a very, very small percentage of women who complain of low sex drive or low desire. So once you screen out for the other things, that someone has a medical condition, someone's on medication, someone's in a bad relationship, someone has an abuse history, you know, once you screen out someone's husband or partner is a poor lover, has bad technique, has bad breath, has not good hygiene, or isn't paying attention to the men anymore. Once you screen out all that stuff, you only have, you know, maybe at most, you know, 15% of the people have low desire, you know, that have it. And so it's really, you know, if you screen out all the people who have other issues contributing, the contextual issues, then, you know, people who are using it have better success, but it's in a very small population. So, take most of the women, and it's not approved over a certain age. So, you know, after menopause, it wasn't in the trials, right? So there goes, you know, a huge part of your population too. So, yeah,
absolutely.
So the low desire, but the point is that, you know, intimate connections is the desire sometimes isn't something that's hormonally influenced, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we think of desire as being horny, that, you know, we have good testosterone levels, men and women, right? And we just, you know, instinctively are going to want to have sex, you know, if there's a sexual relevant, you know, situation in front of us, right? But that's not the case. And you know, those of us, you know, in the field, there's someone called Dr. Rosemary Bassoon, who has this alternative model of human sexual response for women. And sometimes there's a lot of different things that motivate us to be receptive to sexual activity, And that, so those motivations, like the desire to be close, to be intimate, to accommodate your partner, whatever it might be, might lead you to sexual activity. And then the sexual activity may then spark your desire, right? So desire is more, you know, that we all yearn for connection. That's a belief I have, a fundamental belief.
Absolutely.
You know,
I agree with you.
And that connection with a sexual partner is very special, because you could have some great connections with your family or friends, but if you're missing out on the sexual component, it just doesn't quite match. And so we have that yearning desire. So it's that desire to be connected with somebody, desire to be really known by somebody. So it's what your heart wants and what your soul needs. You know, I get very soulful. There's a chapter on spirituality and what your gut says, you know. So it's not, okay, I don't feel horny anymore, I don't have desire. Well, when you're in the right context and someone's treating you well, you know, that desire will blossom. Or if, you know, you have that desire to be close to somebody, and you know, I think all people want to be accepted and unconditionally loved by one other person, you know?
Yes, we have that very deep need to be known, really known by another. And that's an important part of intimacy. And when we have that, it can transform our lives. It can be transcendent. And but people with disabilities have that much more of a challenge. But if you overcome the challenges, then you perhaps can have even deeper intimacy. I imagine you and your wife, Cheryl, have really very deep intimacy, that you know each other well, you communicate well, you have this high awareness, which is your secret number 6, awareness and acceptance. You must have that with your wife.
Yes, I mean, we've been married now 30 years, going on 31 years. We've been together for longer. Even, you know, we were good communicators even, you know, from the start, you know. So we talked about, like, our affairs when we got married. You know, I was like, let's just get married for 7 years, and decide at the end of 7 years, because she had her affairs, I had my affairs, right? So I said, let's go into this eyes wide open, and let's do it for 7 years. At the end of 7 years, we'll reevaluate. And we did, and we did it a few times until we stopped. You know, now, you know, it's kind of like 30, going on 31 years. So,
But you know, what a modern way to do it. Every 7 years, we'll evaluate. And then that forces you to look at what's working in your relationship and what's not working.
Yeah. So, if we, you know, I think the longer you're in this field, the less romantic you are. I don't want to say, I think I'm, you know, you're, I don't want to say you're jaded about love, but I mean, it's like, you know, there's another thing is, you know, one of my secrets is love is an action, not a feeling. You know,
yes,
love
you
is very, very complex. Very complex. And, you know, when I'm doing a large, like a show, and people can do voting, you know, I say love is an action, not a feel. True, you know, agree or disagree. And, like, generally 68 to 70% disagree with that. And so, of course, I'm being, you know, a little bit, you know, I don't know, what do you call it? Egging people on by challenging them and saying it's an action, not a feeling. Because most of us know love is a feeling. And I'm a trained peers facilitators, which is like practical applications of intimate relationships. And so in peers, they say, love is a feeling. You know, marriage is a contract. Relationships take work, right? So even in the program on trading, they say love is a feeling. And the Western view of love really embodies Greek mythology. It just happens to you. You know, it's Cupid's arrow shoots you in the heart. But it usually shoots you in the groin, right?
Right.
So, you know, what we know of love is usually lust or sexual arousal. And we say we fall in love, and it's out of our control. And, you know, I fall in love all the time, and it's in my control, what I do with that love, you know? So, but when love is an action, we actually focus on another person's virtues, you know, and it's intellectual, it's our choice, you know, and we are in control. It's a whole different model. It's about conscious intention. It's about energy. And it's about working together. So, you know, there are all
and it takes time, you say. It takes time.
Real love, quote unquote, I think, to really know somebody. I mean, so many people date for years, right? Mm-hmm. And they get married or move in together, and all of a sudden shit hits the fan. Can I say that on the radio? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, you can say most anything because it's internet radio.
So, and they don't understand what happened, you know, mm-hmm. and it's because you don't really get to know somebody until you live with them, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, really mm-hmm. live with them, share the bathroom, you know, share, you know, every part of the day, you know, so you have to be able to accept that stuff that's hidden for sometimes so long. And sometimes people's most, you know, people's things that they are most insecure about, they never reveal in a dating relationship, right? Because they could hide it. But when you're with somebody all the time, you know, then you sometimes get a sneak peek into those fares. Or if you don't see the fares, you see the behaviors that are based on those fares.
You're saying fears.
Yeah.
So many, fears. So I think something that inhibits a lot of sexuality are big time fears. We could do a whole show on sexual fears. They're in existence for sure. Many, many people have all kinds of fears, even able-bodied people. Lots of fears. It's just a part.
Well, that's where I think mm-hmm. that these findings, although they come from a study of people with spinal cord injuries, when you look across other populations, you see that there's universal truth here. And so the regain that feeling secrets of sexual self-discovery, the tagline is people living with spinal cord injuries share profound insights into sex, pleasure, relationships, orgasm, and the importance of connectedness. But it's meant to be a message for everybody, you know, that even in the loss of movement and sensation and sexual response, you know, in the genitals, that people can find really connection and pleasure and orgasm. So, mm-hmm. you know, basically it's like, if I can do it, you can do it. It may take cleaning up this part of your life. It may take a little work, but it's an investment well worth your effort.
Absolutely it is. You say that sort of under the heading of love is an action, not a feeling. So what practical tip or tool can you share with listeners that they can start using immediately? Immediately. Practical tip or tool.
This doesn't go to love is an action, not a feeling, but something that it could expand your creativity and your adaptability. Something as simple as if you're in a partner relationship and you sleep together,
mm-hmm.
get in bed on the opposite side of the bed.
Okay.
And then approach each other and don't just go right on top, you know, or, you know, put your arm in a sling, you know, and take one arm out of the game and see what you have to do to adapt and, to pleasure each other. So, you know, those are real practical things that you could do is basically to begin to change it up. Because as soon as you do anything, change the side of the bed, put your arm in a sling, your whole routine changes, your whole script, right? And so if you work with that in a playful way, a creative way, go into it with a sense of humor, you will discover new things about yourself. You will discover new ways to touch. You will discover new positions, right? So that's
and then that creates dopamine in the brain. And dopamine is the hormone of arousal, and dopamine needs novelty. So you bring a little novelty in. Into your sexual relationship by changing things up.
Right.
People with disabilities have to do that.
We have got to
explore and experiment because you have limitations.
And exploring and experimentation leads to more exploring and experimentation because
once
you discover something and you see, I didn't know that could feel so good. Wow, I didn't know that could, you know, cause an orgasm, I'm going to explore more. So once people get out of their routine, and mm-hmm. discover something new, it's like self-perpetuating.
It really is. And because the person feels more confidence.
Right.
I can do this and look at the results. More pleasure. You know, we would be so much better off in our society if we had more healthy pleasures.
Absolutely.
Just happier. And a lot of people with disabilities have serious depression, don't they? So they need to have orgasm and relating and intimate relating in order to counteract the depression.
Yeah, there's definitely a disparity with more people with just not disabilities, but disabilities and chronic conditions supporting, you know, having depression in addition to that. So, yeah, we have to do something every day that feels good. You know, we have to consciously, even if it's for 10 minutes, treat ourselves not necessarily to something sexual, but to something pleasurable, you know. And, you know, because if you're not having any pleasure, one of the diagnostic criteria of depression is lack of any pleasure, right? So
right.
If you're not having any pleasure, you're not going to have sexual pleasure.
No, that's very true. So as it turned out, we didn't have any callers, and that's all right. But if somebody with a disability wants to contact you, how would they best do it? Question number one, as we wind up the show,
right.
How would they best contact you, and also the best way to get your book, Regain That Feeling, Secrets to Sexual Self-Discovery? So two-part question.
Okay. So to contact me, it's reliable. Use the contact form on drmitchellteppere.com, drmitchellteppere.com, mm-hmm. and just click contact. I get contacts almost every day. Mm-hmm. And then to buy the book, you can look through it on the site, but I have a separate site just called regainthatfeeling.com. And on that site, there's a link over to Amazon, or you could search Amazon for my name. But there's also a discount code for, I think, 20% off CreateSpace. So if people go to Regain That Feeling and they want to get the discount, it's a larger discount than Amazon, they could go to regainthatfeeling.com and copy that code and click through. It'll take you directly to the page, and you could order it that way.
Dr. Mitchell Tepper, I want to thank you so much. You've contributed really a lot today to this program, and I'm delighted that you'll be back in 2 weeks on March the 7th, and we'll talk some more. There's much to explore here, and we'll focus in 2 weeks on your project with Dr. Mark Schoen, Making Love After Making War. So that'll expand on some of what we talked about. So thank you again, Dr. Mitchell. We'll talk some more in 2 weeks. Goodbye, everybody. Happy feet.